Our assumption is that people will be able to do things that 3 or 4 years ago they just couldn't even conceptualise, and they'll be able to do it quickly and easily.
We see built by mariners for mariners, things that demonstrate that we are listening.
Digitisation is probably the easiest way to gain significant commercial advantage. You definitely don't need a shipyard to do digitisation, you just need access to the ShipNet webpage and to drop us a note.
Welcome to Talking Ship. I'm Zoe Hanson, your host on this episode, joined by the brilliant John Wills and the fabulous Jenny Duffy from ShipNet. Hi, guys.
Hi, there, Zoe.
So, Jenny Duffy, you are the marketing director at ShipNet. How long have you been there for?
I have been there for 3 years and 3 months, Zoe. Yeah, so quite some time. It's gone very fast, though.
And so, what do you enjoy about it?
It's a lot more different than I had anticipated. The energy is brilliant. I've never worked with a team that are so, well, they're funny, engaging, and I hate to say it because John's here, but very, very smart.
Well, so that leads me in. Look, Jenny's given you an amazing introduction there, yeah. John. John, you are the Director of Customer Experience at ShipNet. What does that mean?
It kind of feels like the buck stops with me most days. So I own product, I own support, and I own our account management. So it's sort of like almost all the customer interface is with me. So I've been at ShipNet for about 5.5 years, something like that now. And I was a transplant from non-maritime industries, so into marine. So I'm about 8 years in marine total now.
Why go into shipping?
Oh, complete accident. Complete accident. Rather than have my family starve to death, I thought I'd get a job.
Mm.
And that job, I happened to end up going into a sales role in a company that was mainly doing vessel performance analysis. And like all vessel performance analysis companies, that one failed after a couple of years. And then I ended up at ShipNet. But the thing that makes ShipNet kind of more compelling than just your average job is we work with some of the biggest ship owners in the world. So we've got people like MOL, we've got people like Wilson, we've got the Synergy Ship Management Group work with us loads. And that's brilliant because I'm a bit of an economics geek. Mm-hmm. And economics is basically trade, you know, however you cut it. And these are companies that kind of have major parts playing driving global trade. So I get to see the thing that I'm kind of interested in academically, like the practicalities of it, the gears going around every day. And that's probably what's kept me here. Oh, that and Jenny too.
Oh, yes, of course.
Of course.
And customer experience. Mm. How do you... Did you just come up with that?
No, that was my boss gave me that title. But the idea is that if you get... So everybody has to support their customers, and that's largely a technical thing. But what we have is we have account managers who are just responsible for the customer relationship. And then we've got a really talented product team that sit next to them. So the idea is basically that product find out what customers need direct from the customers via the account managers, and they find out where the product is deficient through support. So it's this kind of virtuous circle of feedback. Every little bit of information that comes into my area gets incorporated into the plans for the product, and everything gets better over time. The customers talk to us, they see things happen, they become happier, they tell their friends, more people use ShipNet, the world becomes a happier, shinier place with lambs gambling, butterflies flitting through sylvan glades, and so on and so forth.
To be honest, with the customer experience part, we did struggle with what we would call it, didn't we? Because in tech now, there's a lot of customer experience or customer happenings. I read recently, and I don't even know what that means. Mm. So we did kind of, because it's new to ShipNet, we've never had that department. And we're starting from the ground up, and obviously John's building it. We struggle with the title. There were some funny brainstormings, yes, which I don't think are appropriate for this podcast.
And actually, I wanted to ask you, John, about the sort of technical advances, because shipping, I suppose, is sort of seen as quite old-fashioned, yeah, maybe. And then actually, it sounds as if it's been sort of super boosted into the future all of a sudden.
I'm really fortunate. So I used to work with people, central government, NHS, telecoms, charities. I set up housing associations and things like that for about a decade. And all of those people have gone through the kind of transformation that access to data in large volumes and the tools with which to manipulate that data for insight. They've gone through all of that. But I walked into shipping at a period of time where people were just starting to talk about the potential for digitization. And I've kind of ended up at the right place at the right time because I've done all of this. with the government. I've done it with the NHS. I've done it with telecoms companies. And now I'm working with these huge, huge, huge businesses who are like, look, we know we need to do this, but we're not quite sure where to start. So shipping is going through the curve that everybody else went through, say, 10 years ago. And it just happens to be doing it now. But the interesting thing is that there's also a wash of new graduates coming in to the industry who are like digital first guys.
Right.
So there's this really interesting kind of like cultural thing happening with the old and the new colliding at a time when technology has never been more capable or cheaper. So that I think the next 5 years are going to be interesting. In 10 years, I suspect we'll not really know. We won't really be able to recognise the old industry anymore.
So where do you start then? Are people still using, you know, a ledger and, you know, a paper map?
In my head, I wish they weren't.
I'm not joking. I went to a customer about 3 years ago who had recently graduated from a paper ledger for accounts to spreadsheets, and then they came to us. So it's there's only been one of those, but yeah, they do exist. So where we start, really, shipping companies have been creating data for years and years and years. So every day.
But what, they haven't really known it?
Well, it's more a case of they didn't have the tools to do much with it, I think. So okay. if you own a ship, if you own a ship, until relatively recently, the only way you would know where that ship was you get a fax or a telex in the middle of the day, noon, saying, oh, we're here, we've got this much fuel on board, we think we're going to get to port on this day and date at this time, and this is the port we're heading for. And that was the sum total of the data. Now, that expanded with the ability to send emails and stuff from ship, and most people upgraded to a spreadsheet. And there was a bit more data on there. But the thing is that all of that data still exists within shipping companies. What they've not really had is the ability to do much with it. So if you've got that kind of very simple data, this is how much fuel we burned in the last 24 hours, this is where we started, this is where we finished, you can actually construct a kind of ongoing efficiency picture of the vessel.
Okay.
On what days did you burn less fuel to go the furthest distance? Now, the tools that people have access to easily now let them do that. 5-10 years ago, they didn't. But those data resources are still there in businesses, but not everybody has gotten around to doing something with them yet. And part of what ShipNet does is actually give people a single platform in which to put all that data so they can analyze it and find out what they do well, what they do less well, and maybe areas that they don't do anything in at the moment that other people do have success in that they should look to expand into.
And Jenny, being in marketing, do you see all of these changes and all of these advances?
I think so. I mean, I joined with no shipping experience. It took me about a couple of years to not call them boats, so and container ships, which I got into trouble for. But so I came into it very naively with a kind of clean sheet about what it was, with some preconceptions, which I think have been shot quite quickly. But even in the last, I think, 6 months, we're speeding up so fast. We've got obviously Neil in product as well. We're building things I didn't think were possible probably when I started a couple of years ago even. So yeah, I'm seeing them. When you take something like this to market, I mean, in marketing, you have to have a compelling story. So more often than not, I'm shouting at John lovingly, but I'm shouting at him for more content and what's the story? Yeah. Because there's a real, the people that are listening, especially listening to this, they want to still be engaged.
Of course.
You know, they still want to find out the stories from the guys on the vessels, not boats. They want to hear those stories. So from a marketing point of view, what I'm trying to do is bring the human brain, as it were, to talking about shipping and not the old school, what I grew up with, the shipping forecast, which I still love.
Is it about the why? So, you know, why does shipping need digitization?
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that. And I think that's possibly one of the reasons why shipping kind of started later down this curve than industries like finance or healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, the ancient Greeks invented shipping, as we kind of know, around 5,500 years ago. And, you know, just then communicating from the ship to the shore was not possible. So people on board ship got very good at making decisions on relatively small amounts of data.
Right.
And people who own the cargo or own the vessel itself ashore got used to making their decisions with very small amounts of data. So quite simply, the industry kind of got by for years and years and years and years doing what it needed to do, which was move things that you, me, our kids, our family find really useful from where they're made on the other side of the planet to where they're needed here. I think the difference is that in recent years, particularly with the sort of massive expansion of global trade afforded by China rising in the East and manufacturing kind of dying off in much of the West, margins became smaller, just-in-time delivery became more important. So the pressures on the shipping companies grew, and they probably grew exponentially. And it's not quite evolve or die, because we can't get by without shipping, but people expect goods to be cheaper year on year. People expect the fuller range of goods. You know, if you go into Sainsbury's and you can't buy a pineapple, nowadays it's like the world's coming to an end. And my father can remember the first time he saw a pineapple. And that's not just because he's from Birmingham and has only a passing understanding of fresh fruit. But, you know, it's become more important that the supply chain is resilient, that it delivers with a minimal overhead and so on and so forth. And that's where I think companies are increasingly looking to say, well, look, we need to be better, either because we want to make more money or because our customers expect it of us. So what can we do to improve? Mm-hmm. And there's a whole raft. Digitization is not the only show in town. You know, you've got low carbon intensity fuels, you've got new hull designs, you've got energy saving devices that you bolt onto the ships and like in the form of Muse propellers or, you know, that kind of thing. But digitization is probably the easiest way to gain significant commercial advantage. You definitely don't need a shipyard to do digitization. You just need access to the ShipNet webpage and to drop us a note.
No, exactly. It's quick and simple. I remember you saying to me, because I kind of came with this lack of expectation and maybe a bias towards was shipping ruining the planet. But John, having spoken to John, I remember you said that if we didn't, the lights wouldn't be on in Singapore. Do you remember that?
Oh, God, yeah.
No. Just simple things.
Yeah. So, I mean, when it's kind of terrifying when you really think about it. So, you know, we're recording this in the south of England, very nice hotel. And England, the UK, is an island nation. And if we lost access to shipping, we would have a limited period of time where we had fuel to run our cars. Mm-hmm. Where we had access to medicines, where we had food that we didn't have to forage from within walking distance of our house. We'd go back to, in other words, if we lost ships and shipping, we'd kind of go back to the Bronze Age or the Stone Age.
Okay.
In a terrifyingly short period of time. Our medicines come by ship, our building materials come by ship, our food come by ship, our energy comes by ship.
Everything, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, and our ShipNet customers, one of them keeps the lights on in Sydney.
Okay.
And in Tokyo, because they ship LNG from where it's produced out to those cities where it's then turned into electricity. One of our bigger customers, Wilson, move building materials.
Yep.
And they're short sea, small ships, just go around the North Sea and the rest of it. But if Wilson weren't in business, hospitals wouldn't get built, schools wouldn't get built, houses wouldn't get built. You know, this is a weird thought.
I know, it's a really strange.
We've got other customers that move wood around. And without wood, you don't get wood pulp. Without wood pulp, you don't get your daily newspaper. Now, depending on your choice of newspaper, this may or may not be a good thing. But it's a small thing. We've because of the direction of the global economy and globalization, we've lost the ability. We no longer do this stuff ourselves. Therefore, we're dependent on the people who do it to get that stuff that we need to us. And I think that's the other side of shipping, really. That's the interesting bit.
No, I know. I think so. I remember when I got the job and a friend of mine was saying, oh, you're working in shipping, as he sat there with his earbook and his phone and his groovy other stuff that clearly got there.
Got shipped.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And saying things like that, people go, okay, I see. It's not just so glib. So it's been a massive education for me.
And so, how has the advent of the new technologies then, what opportunities has that opened up? Because I know I've heard you mention Helix. Can you explain what Helix is?
An enormous sky bucket full of your data. Yeah, basically. It's an infrastructure thing more than anything else. But if you imagine that every company produces tons of data, it just does it. It's a byproduct. If you had all of that data neatly sorted, so you could almost sit down and read it, you would essentially be able to conceptualize your entire business as kind of like a digital twin Yeah. So everything you do, whether you move cargo, whether consumption of spares, how much fuel you burn, how much carbon you emit, if you imagine all of that was easily available to you,
yep.
The thing that that data would exist within is Helix. Yeah. And you okay. can then connect whatever tools you're happiest working with to. If you want to connect Excel, because like our boss, mm-hmm. you just love
yeah,
the Excel.
He loves the spreadsheet.
It's a weird thing. Or if you want to be relatively modern and use Power BI, if you want to go full data science and connect like, I don't know, R or Python or some sort of AI ML platform to it, you can do that. The reason why you would do it is dead straightforward. You know, what are we good at? What are we bad at? And what's the cost and the benefit of becoming better in either of those
right.
things? So it's a kind of, should we go for a marketing metaphor?
Do it.
It's a digital mirror you hold up to your
oh,
business.
Oh, maybe don't do it.
Okay. Yeah,
no, that was beautiful.
That was a reach. But that's the point of it. Now, because shipping is used to doing a lot with a relatively small amount of data, if you give people a relatively large amount of data and you give them the tools to analyze it, our assumption is that people will be able to do things that 3 or 4 years ago they just couldn't even conceptualize, and they'll be able to do it quickly and easily.
And it will almost come up with the answers for you. You put the data in, and then it comes up with,
yeah.
Here you go. Here's a solution. It's going to save you X.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the tools that people use nowadays, so even if you just connect Power BI to it, you know, you've got the Microsoft AI tool called Copilot that exists within that. And that's really good for doing sort of like, oh, I wonder kind of analyses. Mm-hmm. So you don't even need to be a sort of like a data scientist or a statistician or even a competent accountant to sit there and learn something about your business, because you've got all of these third-party tools out there now that are really well integrated with the analysis tool set. So you can sort of poke and prod and find out things that you would never find out. Out of all the products that I've pitched over the years to customers, like existing and conceptually new ones, it's probably the one that people engage yeah. with most readily. Even though it's kind of strange because it's a bit abstract. So the big yeah. bucket of data in the sky, and then you can sort of learn from your business using the tools that you want. I think it would be a difficult sell in some industries
yes.
because it's not, you can't show them a screenshot.
No.
There is no screenshot. It's a concept. Get with it. But one of the great things about shipping is that, and I can say this having worked across 4 or 5 different industries in the past, clever people seem to flock to shipping.
Yeah.
So, you know, you are literally working with the best and the brightest. You're working with people who command billion-dollar asset fleets, you know, because ships are what my wife calls a considered purchase. you don't get the opportunity to run a couple of $1 billion worth no. of steel around the oceans with all kinds of valuable stuff on it if you're thick. So people get it really quickly. We've not had any pushback, really. We've had people who have sort of like, oh yeah, you know, as if you can explain the data security aspect.
Yes, I think that's been a thing.
We'll be in with it quick. But nobody's sort of gone, yeah, it's not really for us. And normally,
okay.
if you're launching a product and 50% of the people you show it to say, yeah, we like it, we'll take it, that is a runaway success. So on this one, we're looking at the sort of forecast for it, and we're getting a little bit scared.
Yes, I think so, in a good way.
Because the numbers are high.
Yeah, just the take-up's been really high. We're offering it to our existing customers. We're basically discounting it, so people can just pick it up and start using it. And because it's open-ended, it's kind of like Lego for grown-ups who care
okay.
about chips and data. You
yeah.
can sort of build what you want with it.
So like your Sky package.
No, it's oh Christ, how long is it since I actually watched television? No, but it is like sort of like, here's all of the data about your business, and you can play with it, and you can find out things you didn't know about yourself.
Yeah.
And because yeah. you do this with clever people, and they go, oh, what, really? Yeah, yeah, just get going. Build stuff in it, find out stuff, and then we'll come back and we'll have a conversation about what you really are going to do with it. We're in that conversation stage now with, I think, 5 or 6 customers. We've got about 4,500. No, we had another one sign
Ooh, really?
Up last week.
Excellent.
Which is probably about another 1,000 years worth of data.
Oh my gosh.
So we're knocking on the door of 6,000 operating years of data. So in other words, if you put to sea in that first Greek ship
yeah.
and you sailed it continuously, recording everything you did along the way,
yeah.
you'd have roughly the same amount of data now. Helix has got.
That sort of blows my mind, though.
It's those kind of facts that I think learning along the way have been brilliant.
Yeah.
It's difficult at the moment because people are using all the word data and the word flies around. It's the same with insight and innovation. They're a bit buzzy, aren't they?
Innovation's my least favourite.
No, it's my least favourite as well. Because what does it mean? We can also, it's like kind of trust. You know, of course we want to be innovative. Of course we want to give you insights. But I think what we've done is build a real life kind of engagement piece where people can see how it makes sense and is relative to them and not just that buzzword, that which is exactly what I was trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting as well because I'm hearing lots about shipping regulation and changes and lots of new regs coming in.
Yeah, I mean, shipping's always been... So shipping's a funny one because it's supranational. Yeah, you know, the whole concept of international waters. You know, who's in charge in the middle?
No, that's right.
The short answer is it's the IMO. So that's a subset of the UN. And they've come up with rules for years. Safety of life at sea, you know, SOLAS, MARPOL, maritime pollution stuff. So that's there. But in the last couple of years, we've seen bodies like the EU sort of start to regulate to drive down carbon emissions.
Because
the one fact that most people know about shipping is that it emits the same amount of carbon dioxide as Germany.
Yes.
Which on the face of it, you think, oh my God, that's awful. You know, what a dreadful industry. Whereas, you know, carbon is a proxy measure for fuel because every ton of fuel you burn, you generate just over 3 tons of carbon. And ships burn fuel to do useful work, to get the goods into your home, to get the IKEA sofas from where they're made from pencil shavings.
Yep, that's right.
Ships. So if you work in shipping, and as occasionally happens to me, sisters, other halves go, oh yeah, you work in shipping, man, that like produces loads of carbon and that's bad. You go, well, actually, when you're in shipping and somebody says, oh, you produce as much carbon as Germany, you go, wow, we must be doing loads of really high value, exciting, useful stuff for all of humanity.
Yeah. Mm.
It doesn't get me invited to many dinner parties.
No,
it's a hard sell.
I can imagine. No, you're doing it. You're doing it proud.
But that doesn't mean that emitting as much carbon as Germany is a good thing. You know, you should do the same amount.
There's always more to be done, but actually, you're not in a you're not in bad shape at the moment.
I think that's the best way to put it.
As a man who likes his consumer goods, I'd prefer to have shipping and no Germany. So if we're really going to be made to pick, you know,
edit this bit.
Auf Wiedersehen, Hamburg.
Yes.
Apologies to our German customers.
Are the regulations going to take down the emissions then?
Yes, that's the theory. As with all things invented by politicians, it's there's a few steps in between. I think the way that we're seeing it, and certainly talking to one of our big customers last week about this, is we're going to get people to use Helix, put their emissions data in Helix, and then they can export that emissions data from Helix to the regulator.
Okay.
What the regulator will then do is say, well, look, you know, you've emitted this many tons of carbon. Mm. You need to cover those carbon emissions with carbon credits. They call them EUAs because they're an invention of the EU, so they've got to be appropriately branded. What the EUAs do is they essentially add an additional cost onto your fuel. So your average ship burns 20 tons of fuel a day.
Right. You know,
each ton costs around, I think it's about $400 at the moment. Each ton of fuel you burn generates 3 tons of carbon. You will need to, by September next year, produce 3 carbon credits to cover the emissions from each ton of fuel. Each carbon credit, as of this morning, I think was about $68. So your $400 ton of fuel, by the time you get to next September, if you bought the carbon credits today, will actually cost you closer to $600. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a big, big, big deal for shipping.
Yeah.
So fuel is the single most significant voyage-related cost. Yeah. So it drives everything. If you can reduce your fuel costs, you become more profitable. What the EU have done, and I suspect that the IMO will follow, but I'm going to go talk to the IMO in a week or so about this, is they've just increased the cost of an individual voyage by 50%. So, and we all know what happens when the price of something goes up, people use less of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, in theory, this is absolutely fantastic stuff. In the same way that cigarettes have been made more expensive if you're in the UK, other nationalities, tax regimes may be different. And alcohol is now more expensive, so people generally are using less, except in Scotland.
No, we don't.
I'll leave that with you. Mm-hmm. We've just made fuel massively more expensive. So the expectation is that shipping companies will become cleverer about burning fuel.
Okay.
Now, the hope is that people will use the ships to do more work for less fuel. So maybe they do fewer voyages in ballast when they're not carrying cargo.
Okay.
And in the long term, people will ditch older ships that tend to be less fuel efficient than new ones. But it's a long, long, long game. And if a ship owner messes up the compliance with these regulations now, it's pretty profound stuff. If you all of a sudden get to August next year and need to buy like $5 million worth of carbon credits, well, where are you going to get the $5 million from? Shipping can be a very, very narrow margin business.
Uh-huh. That's what I'm getting from this whole conversation, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a multi-million dollar industry, but actually, it, just the same as anything else, you're looking for those margins.
It is. It's the marginal benefit. If everything in shipping can be 1% better, you know, everything gets better for everybody. And that includes us as users of shipping. But I suppose that's the play with Helix. If we give you all of the data, you can go through and find those things that matter to you.
Yep.
It might be reducing your carbon exposure. It might be shortening the length of time from needing a spare to receiving a spare on ship. It might be reducing the amount of spares you have to carry on the ship because, you know, you reduce your parts bill by 1%. One of our customers spends $500 million a year on spare parts.
Finding things that matter to you.
Yeah.
That's good. I think we'll use that one. Thanks, John.
I still prefer digital mirror and data bucket.
Okay.
The data bucket is a winner. So shipping, I mean, it's literally moving forward, isn't it? Right? That's Hopefully. What it is. Yeah. That's what it's doing, right?
If it goes downwards, that's the problem.
Yeah. We don't want any of that stuff. But it's about moving forward. It's about that continuous improvement. Mm. It's about these new things. It's about being able to be more efficient. Mm. What else is there that you can see that you think, right, yeah, Helix can probably help with that?
When you hear people talk about, oh, what's the future of shipping? It's very easy to give a glib answer, like the ships will be cleaner, they may be autonomous, although I'm not sure the economic cases for autonomy stack up, but other people are cleverer than they do. It might be that we get into different kind of ownership models. So what does an Uber for shipping look like?
Right.
Yeah, you know.
Is that like Seascanner? I just made up a new business.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking
like
about.
Like Skyscanner, right? Yeah. You're looking for your flights.
Yeah, that's mine, by the way. If anyone's listening, copyright to Jen. Jenny Duffy.
This is very much a VC conversation, isn't it? I've got a brand. I have nothing else but the brand. Can I please have $10 million to get the ball going?
I think I'd win that one.
But no, there are things out there. I think there's big questions about whether there's sort of like traditional owner-operator shipping company that just occupies that middle bit of the supply chain.
Right.
You get people produce stuff over here, it goes on a ship, and then it goes off, and then who knows what happens here. Maybe that's an older fashioned model, and maybe that in 50 years will go. I do think that there is a bit of a disjoint around that. So I used to work for a guy called Archie Norman, who's now the chairman of Marks & Spencer's. And when he went to Marks & Spencer's, I sort of read their Plan A sustainability document.
Okay.
Now, bearing in mind Marks & Spencer's, just like every other sort of like clothing retailer in the world, has their production out in the Far East or you know, the Indian subcontinent. And clothes are individually relatively low value items. They're not like iPhones that actually do get flown around because it's cost effective to move an iPhone. So all these things go on container ships and they all come over, the clothes. There wasn't one single mention of shipping in that document. How can you have a sustainability plan for one of the biggest clothing retailers in the UK and just sort of go, anyway,
just miss that bit.
When it gets to Folkestone, we'll put it on a clean lorry. How about that?
What?
So I think that what we will find is probably in the next 10 or 15 years, a deeper level of supply chain integration will
go.
But yet again, people have been saying that for about 20 years now, and it's not really happened.
Because it's that bit that you don't hear of.
Mm.
You know, I live in Southampton. This is a big port.
Yes.
And it's very busy. And the amount of ships that come in and out, I would never have thought about it before I lived there, before I actually saw it. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it's like cooking the food. You know, you don't just discount that bit, do you? Yeah.
No, and I mean, Jen and I were talking we talk endlessly about rubbish like this, but it's the sort of the behind the curtain nature of shipping in most people's everyday life. You know, I look at it as an economics nerd from the sort of, well, where do you think all this stuff comes from? Jen's a creative person, so she doesn't think about that.
But no.
she notices that when you join a shipping company, all of a sudden you're conscious about where this idiom comes from. Oh, it's heavy weather doing this project. Well, that didn't come from anywhere apart from shipping.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that one's hold below the waterline, that idea. Again, shipping. You know, oh, we're on our beam ends. It's so difficult here at the moment. I notice all of these are...
Ship shape.
Ship shape. Oh, that's a good one.
Thank you.
I was worried it was all going to be downbeat stuff.
No, I can't think of it. There's loads, but
You know.
Did you know that more accidents on vessels are likely to happen in fairer weather?
Why?
Exactly. Because people, summary, are less worried about what's happened because they think everything's going to be fine because the weather's there, the sea is calm, so they're not as alert as they are when the weather is rough.
It's a clear road.
Exactly. But it's small fat like that. I mean, I find these kind of things really quite interesting because you can put them into your content and build a brand around that.
That's the hypothesis. More accidents will happen on ship in fair weather. Reason for that being actually fair weather's much more common at sea than the really bad weather that we have in our minds from maybe watching things like Perfect Storm. And also, you know, so the majority of your working hours is in good weather, so statistically it's more likely, but also people are less careful. There's a great thing. The first time I ever went on board an oil tanker, it was tied up at Fawley just down the road. And Fawley's a difficult place to get into. They, like, if you've got a cigarette lighter or something, they'll shoot you because obviously Fawley's slightly flammable.
Of course,
And you have to have your protective clothing on. So I was given a pair of steel toe-cap shoes, which were so heavy I could barely walk in them. I had, like, a high-vis jacket. I had a helmet. I had eye protection. I had a big backpack full of tools because we're going on there to do a service. And so I sort of shuffle up the gangplank and I hand my passport in and I'm there like some sort of half-assed version of Batman with all this stuff hanging off me. I'm greeted by the captain who's wearing flip-flops, shorts and a singlet. Welcome to my ship.
Did you feel silly?
I felt ludicrous. I still have those shoes though. It's mainly because I can't.
You've got a mental image of this.
I can't lift them.
Tap dancing.
Oh, terrible. But we don't. But I think one of the other things is that we genuinely don't know that. That's the hypothesis. There's some evidence out there to support it. But there are safety management systems on board ships where you log this kind of accident. They don't have an independent weather record associated with them.
Okay.
So you only know what the weather's like based on self-reporting, and not everybody records what the weather's like.
Of course. So then it's just presumed that it was fair weather.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we plumbed into Helix, I think it was the first external data set that we added, because we put data into Helix for our customers so they have some better context, was the NOAA weather data. So it's the last 7 years, I think, of data. It's about eight petabytes of data. Terabytes? Petabytes? That was a lot of data.
It's a lot of bytes.
Yeah, we put that in there so people could go, right, plot my accidents, including my near misses, and then show me what the rain was doing, show me what the wind was doing and what the sea state was, and we'll see if there's a clump on that. And that's going to be one of the first things. We'll put together a paper when we've got a bit more customer data in there, like maybe another 5,000 years worth.
What, next week?
Yeah, probably. and then we'll publish that. And we will then settle. There's a real, you know, we joke about this in some ways because it is so counterintuitive. And it's like, well, how can you not genuinely know this? But there's a group in the States, a legal firm, they've worked out that every accident at sea costs around $45,000. Yeah, so if you have an accident on board your ship, you, on average, you're going to be on the hook for $45,000. Average safety management system costs less than $100,000. So if we give you a safety management system and the ability to interrogate the data and it avoids two accidents, and they don't even have to be severe accidents, that's that safety management system paid for. And you can't really do that reliably with other solutions out there. And that's why we think Helix is a big deal.
Do you know the other thing that comes through with this as well is ShipNet really listen.
Yeah.
Actually, you're completely engrossed in the industry, mm-hmm. But you're listening. And that's where all these things come from, is listening. What's the problem? Okay, mm-hmm. we might come up with a solution for that. What's going on over here? How can we help with that? But you have to listen to understand those things in the first place, don't you?
Yeah. And actually, that comes right back to the customer experience thing. So we literally pay our account managers to work with customers and to listen. There's no sales target. They're not salesmen.
No, right.
They go and they listen. And the first thing they have to do is obviously they have to become expert in their customer.
Yeah.
You know, so we hired a guy from Braemar Shipbrokers. Yeah, so he brings some knowledge of the industry in. But him and his colleague Eddie, and then we've got another guy that we're in the process of recruiting now. They're all good listeners.
Yeah.
I think that's key. And we say built by mariners for mariners, things that demonstrate that we are listening and we're not just building vanity products or solutions that we think we would want to see,
yeah.
which would make us look, I say super sexy, we've got to kind of remember it's still shipping, which would make us look a certain way, but we don't. We're building what our customers want because we're sitting down, taking the time and going, well, you don't really need that, to be honest. We could charge you a fortune for it, but you don't really need it. What you need is this. And I think that's what's starting to turn around. Not that we had a good reputation, but I think that's what's turning around from what I'm hearing in the market is we're not just trying to be, and I won't name the competitors, but we're not just trying to be this big faceless. We're trying to be that. If you buy Shipnet, you buy that peace of mind.
Yes.
And you're not.
And you've got somebody listening.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. So it's good that that's come across because that's very much what we're trying to be.
Yeah, and I think just on straightforward business basis, I think we'll probably close more net new customers this year than we have in the last 4 or 5.
So, absolutely.
That's you rather than us, I think.
Yes, that is me rather than you. I'm going to take that.
Yeah.
We're learning. We're learning every time that in marketing, I mean, I work with a guy called Danny Magic seems to be his nickname, but we rely so heavily on the feedback from John and Neil and people that are and the account managers now, people that are talking to the customers and sales. We need to know what's happening on the ground. We need to know what's working. Or in a demo, what are people going, that's just not what I need. So we don't want to talk about it. So I think internally we really need, and I really need to be able to know what the customers are saying. So I need to know that they are listening.
John and Jenny, thank you so much for sharing your insight. Now, we'd love to know what you think, so drop us a note in the comments. And thank you so much for listening to us talking ship.